My name is Amy Esdorn, and I'm here at the Society of Petroleum Engineers Annual Technical Conference and Exhibition at the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston, Texas. Today is September 29th, 2015, and I'm speaking with Tom Blasingame. Tom, thank you for participating in the interview. Okay, well, let's begin. So my first question for you is, how did you get involved in the industry, and what was the industry like when you began your career?
Very good. I'll start sort of with a personal story, and then I'll work my way up to what the industry was like when I first graduated my baccalaureate degree. When I was a child, my father owned oil field drilling and well service, and he had been a driller at that time for about 25 years. I was born late. I have a sister who's much older than I am, and she has a family of her own, and they lived on their own. But my parents moved to Lake Charles, Louisiana after a hurricane, and my father built a oil and gas well drilling business. And about the time I was born, and we were inseparable. I went to the office with him every day when there was no school. I went to job sites, locations. I drove equipment, usually sitting on his lap, sometimes not. I got into trouble for that a few times. We owned offshore equipment, and we owned an inland drilling barge, which really amounted to me being about the filthiest little boy you ever saw in your life. Those were good days. I thought the oil and gas, that side of it, the drilling and completion side, was the way I was going to go. Unfortunately, my father contracted leukemia, and he died rather quickly in 1973. My mother sold the business essentially at fire sale prices, and we just sort of went back to a non-petroleum-related life. I had a few relatives that were still involved in it, but my mother was able to not have to work based on the proceeds of the business, and I was just a kid. And when I was in high school, I was arguably not a very good student. I, in fact, had pretty terrible grades from time to time. But I did well enough to get into university. I applied several places, and I actually applied in petroleum engineering in a couple. And the reason for going to Texas A&M was basically, they said yes first, so I said, okay, that sounds pretty good. So I went to Texas A&M, and I started out in aerospace engineering, and I liked it, but just to make a long story short, they changed the instructor on us in our initial class, and this fellow wasn't very student-centric, and it was clear they had too many students, and they would like for us to go away. So then I changed majors a couple more times and didn't like that either, and all in the course of about 8 months. And a friend of mine literally put my head in a vise, and, well, figuratively, I guess I should say, and told me I should try petroleum engineering, and I did. And it was a little bit of a rough start. I wasn't really academically prepared. But then sophomore, junior, senior courses, I just got better and better, and the old skills kicked in. And I was pretty happy. I was really at a very good level by the time I actually finished my undergraduate degree. I didn't have any job prospects. I had a really good summer internship. I got this 5-star report, and I was so pumped up over how great my review was. And then that company, which doesn't exist anymore, didn't hire anybody. And I was devastated, and I wondered what I was going to do. And, at the time, it was pretty easy because there were no jobs of any consequence. I mean, there were a few. If you were willing to go to Alaska and had truly phenomenal grades, there were quite a few people that did that. There were a few other jobs here and there as well. But prospects were really, really poor, and a lot like today, especially with people getting their jobs rescinded, that was sort of like the experience. Well, I had a report that was due, sort of a senior thesis, and I'd never met John Lee, but I heard he was pretty good at ideas, so I went and saw him, and he didn't say anything to me. He just reached up in his bookshelf, got a book, handed me put a post-it note in it, handed it to me, and told me, go figure out everything about that topic and then come talk to him. And after a bit of a story, I did, and I took him my work back, and we had a nice chat. And this was about midway through my senior year, and he really liked what he saw, and he encouraged me to go to graduate school. And that was pretty much the start of my career. And I look back, and, you know, you think about every young person, and the reason that they're so motivated is because they don't know they can fail. They don't know that there are obstacles out there that they can't see, or things that will happen that they can't overcome, perhaps. And, you know, it was a tough time. The industry went into a slump for quite a while, but I went into graduate school instead. And I have to say this, I know it's probably going to get me into trouble, but I would go to graduate school for 1,000 years before I'd go back to undergraduate for a day. I really fell in love with graduate school, and I really, probably whatever the opposite of being in love was with undergraduate, it was sort of like being in boot camp for 4 years, getting, you know, pressed into the discipline and so forth. But that was the start of my career, and that was where the job market was in 1984. And the surprising thing is things didn't really bottom out for another couple of years, but the number of graduates dropped precipitously and the number of students dropped precipitously. But about the time I finished my PhD in 1989, things were picking up somewhat, but I really at that point did not want to work, and not as a, you know, as a job, I guess. I really loved the academic and the creative lifestyle, and I became a postdoc and then eventually a junior faculty member. So that was really the start of my career in the oil and gas industry, and a little bit of history to go along with it.
So you've performed a lot of research, and you've sort of in your career so far worked on many technical innovations. Can you discuss some of those?
Sure. Back when I was looking at that problem with Dr. Lee, he planted a seed that he probably didn't realize. It was a problem for variable rate analysis, and it was sort of an older problem, but I had looked at it, and I guess you just have your moment where you see something that nobody else sees, and I saw a way of plotting and analyzing data that really became a whole other branch of reservoir engineering. Eventually, there was a lot of things that went before that, but it also incorporated some work that Mike Fetkovich had done, and it allowed you to use any, you would take data from any rate or pressure profile and analyze it against a prescribed model and estimate reservoir properties and make future production predictions and so forth. That would probably be what I'm best known for, and unfortunately, even after, you know, more than 30 years, you can't really get away from your expertise. And, you know, it's nice to be thought of as the expert in something, but you know, I've done a lot of other things. I've created solutions in well test analysis and other aspects of reservoir engineering, including phase behavior and petrophysics. I wish that I could tell you that, you know, I have all these great and innovative ideas that rival what I did in my youth, but frankly, the problems got a lot harder when we went to ultra-low permeability systems. I've been working on that for about the last 10 years. And, of course, everyone starts by assuming what we did before works on what we're doing now. And sort of my current theme is to try to utilize a best or a most appropriate theory for well performance in these kinds of systems. There have been various, you know, recent work in creating models to see how you can approximate behavior. A paper we have at this conference is on extremely fine scale simulation to understand what actually happens in a fractured media. It's a one of those things where you kind of cartoonize your mind and you say, okay, if I impose this on the system, how does it behave? Because we're not able to represent the system physically, or we can't ever see the physical representation of the system, so we tend to model it. But in order to model something this complicated, we created a random or a stochastic system, and we observe the behavior of that system. I think it'll be interesting work. I think it'll give other people some time to think about things, and maybe others will carry it on. But for myself, what I wanted to see was if we're really effective at stimulating the reservoir, what's the maximum sort of benefit we could get, or what's the maximum expectation of productivity we could get. Work like that. I have also tailored work in the past to a particular student's need or their problem that they're working on. Had a recent effort as well into some extremely complicated thermodynamics for phase behavior. Wasn't really my favorite thing. This is more a domain of chemical engineers. Have also done quite a bit of work when we first started working on unconventional reservoirs or shales on numerical modeling and what those aspects would look like. Nothing that necessarily changed the way we do things, but it gives us a better feel for or more confidence that we can model these things, these behaviors. I'm trying to think if there's anything that I would really say, you know, a visionary statement is that reservoir engineering in unconventionals is going to require a rewriting of the textbooks, a rewriting of the papers. It's going to happen, unfortunately, in increments. It'll be small steps, just like it was for tight gas reservoirs. As a comparison, tight gas 35 years ago seemed like an impossible achievement or an impossible task, and yet now that's fairly common. I think in 25, 30 years, we'll be saying the same thing about ultra-low permeability shales, for example. Whether or not the same physical principles and the same thermodynamics are being used then as we use now remains to be seen. But those are the kinds of problems that I would like to see us emphasize. And again, there's a hornet's nest of activity around these things right now, but they're all about incremental changes. And we have to recognize that this is what happens in an evolutionary process. Things are static until some mutation occurs. And, I'd love to say I know what that mutation is going to be, but I'd rather pressure people to try to, achieve a mutation and then see what our next level of understanding is.
So sounds like, you're, as a professor, part of what you do is sort of mentoring, and I'm sure you've received a lot of really good advice yourself. But what was the best advice that you've been given for working in the industry?
I'm sure everyone agonizes over this question, but I'll tell you, it was the first time I taught a course. We had a department head who was a bit of a legend, but he was just a really nice fella underneath, and he told me, you never know a subject as well as you do 15 minutes before class. What that meant was always be prepared for class, and it also extrapolated into being much more prepared than the students are. And I found, when you deal with students, fairness, kindness, bending over backwards to try to help, some take advantage of. I mean, there's always a dark side to that. But others recognize that even though you're really tough, that the mission is to make them stronger and better, and that they become the next generation. I'd like to mention as well that, I have a bit of a reputation as a tough taskmaster and sometimes even a tough grader. I try not to be cruel, but I try to be very deliberate. If somebody makes a mistake in school, it's a free mistake. Nobody dies. Nothing bad happens. And I also learned, from my most important mentor, I think, John Lee, that, you don't motivate people by crushing their dreams. And I tend to curve as much as possible. I tend to give as much credit as possible. So, in terms of the best advice, I'd go back to Doug about being ready for class, and I'd go back to John about, recognizing that students need something positive in their life, and maybe moreover, they need someone positive in their life, and you want to try to be that. I was also given a piece of advice by a very famous reservoir engineer, and I won't mention his name, but he told me that enhanced oil recovery was a loser and that it's to be avoided at all costs. And at the time, I was pretty impressionable, and I thought, you know, this guy, he's probably making a joke, but this is really terrible advice. But what he meant was that wasn't where his skills lied. And mine either. You know, there are a lot of topics where my skills aren't really suited. And I guess his advice was stay where you're strong. And, you know, some people can adapt. They can change. They can create a whole new field for themselves. I've tried that a bit, Amy, and it just, where I'm strongest is sticking with the fundamentals, sticking with the things that I know how to do. I'm a really good interpretationist and analyst, and you know that can be adapted to other things, and I can teach people how to do that. But things like reservoir modeling or you know, process design or experimental design, really not my cup of tea. But analysis, diagnostics, forecasting, integrating analytic solutions with data, that's probably my strength. And, you know, again, that advice, albeit a bit negative, I think it was meant to inspire and to, you know, to get me to focus. That's probably good enough for now. I think those three people were like gutters at a bowling alley. They kept me honest. So I'm pretty pleased that I had those guys. And also to recognize that there's been a lot of other people that have had strong influence on me personally that maybe I didn't realize it at the time. Wouldn't want to forget them, but, you know, you don't realize at the time that you're learning something. So
absolutely.
Thanks for that that question. That really made me think.
Well, this is my last question for you, and it's, how has being a member of SPE affected your career?
You know, back in the late 80s, when I was just getting my academic career started, the SPE was a vehicle for me to publish. It was a vehicle for me to present. And I never really ever saw myself as, you know, achieving much or accomplishing much or amounting to much. Quite frankly, it was a compulsion. You know, I really believed in my work and I was really pushing. But I never saw myself as a leader. I never saw myself as you know, a contributor. I saw it as a vehicle to not to enhance my career, but to allow me to interject what I was doing into the public domain. And I was really, you know, I was one of those people that was really excited when you got an abstract back and it was approved. You know, I used to feel like you won the lottery, and then, well, I still do actually, but then you feel like, well, you know, is it good enough? And you always want to make sure that your work is relevant and new. Probably in the mid-90s, something strange happened, and I can't really put my finger on it, the exact date and time, but I can tell you what happened. It was that I was asked to co-chair an ATW, an Advanced Technology Workshop, and it may not have been called that at the time. I really don't remember. And I found out I was really good at it. You know, I was able to, I don't like to ask anything for myself, but I have no problem, you know, asking people to do other things for the society. That set in effect, you know, a chain of events where I probably chaired 20 events, and I probably, you know, worked with thousands or thousands upon thousands of people in these events. And, you know, I never really thought about other than that was a call of duty. So I went from using SPE as a vehicle to produce technical work and or to present technical work, and then the service aspect kicked in. Lately, maybe the last 6 or 7 years, I've just sort of fallen into the opportunity to provide a lot of guidance on unconventional reservoirs. So up until Well, I guess technically I've chaired all of SB or co-chaired all of SB's major conferences on unconventional reservoirs in the U.S., and I now co-chair the UR Tech events as well. Tried to get others to step up, by the way, but you know, kind of like everything else, it just follows you, and you need to do that. And I also, in the midst of that, I realized that there are a lot of people who don't get recognition for their service to SPE, and I tend to write a lot of nominations now. I tend to try to think about someone who is really deserving, and they warrant a bit of recognition or a bit of attention, if you want to call it that. And I've been pretty passionate about that for the last 10 years. I'll also say that I've done a lot of international sort of seed work. I had an unofficial education project in the country of Iran, and about that was almost 15 years ago now. And I was helping them to maintain their SPE presence in really a vacuum. There wasn't anything wrong with it at the time, but you know, you see people in places where they don't have a lot of influence or a lot of information coming from the outside. So that would have been one case. And I had a recent education project in the country of Mozambique where we started from nothing, and SPE is their vehicle for communication with the outside world. You didn't ask me this, but I'll tell you, my most rewarding SBE service, without a doubt, and I would recommend anyone who's passionate about it to do so, and that was becoming an SBE Distinguished Lecturer. I really enjoyed that. It was by far the, you know, like the Army used to say, the hardest job you'll ever love. It was pretty brutal. I had a couple of pre-tour you know, deliveries, and then I had something like 28 or 29 deliveries that year, and then three or four the year after, and you just, you know, I did three countries in one day, and, you know, you're like, where the hell am I, and, you know, what time zone is it, and that sort of thing. But unbelievable, the response in places in the world where they don't get to see anybody, you know, and I remember going to Bangladesh without a visa, and I probably shouldn't say that because somebody's going to spank me, but, you know, it was because of Ramadan, and you couldn't get a visa because the embassy was closed, and they said, oh, well, you know, if you have to, you just get back on the plane and go back to Singapore and, you know, go to your next stop or that sort of thing. And so, you know, landed in Dhaka, and there's this giant sign that says, visa, $50, but it was on the other side of immigration. I was like, how the hell do you get a visa? At any rate, somebody walked me through it, and I had a truly, you know, almost an epiphany there, because those guys had very little exposure to the outside world, and it was really an amazing journey in China and Russia and Eastern Europe and places. You know, I told them, I said, I'll go anywhere nobody else wants to go, which is a mistake because they'll definitely send you there. But I would rank that as probably my favorite service. But I'd rank my you know, my dedication to conferences and so forth is probably my most significant service. But the thing that I'm really passionate about right now is give somebody a pat on the back. Not everybody's going to win an international award. Not everybody is going to win a regional award. But nobody's going to win if you don't nominate them and if you don't encourage other people to nominate them, or at least give them a pat on the back. Tell them they're doing a good job. Write a nice note to them and let them know that what they do matters to the society. As opposed to other industries, we have only one professional society, and if this is what we're dealt, then we have to give this organization every bit of attention and credit that we can. And you can tell that I'm really passionate about this, and I believe that for the rest of my career, SBE is going to be my, forgive me, my favorite charity, my favorite passion, and so forth, but I want to see the society encourage technical development. I want them to encourage professional development. But I also want us to realize there are some things that are intangible. And those people who don't have access to things really want and need our input. So I'll stop there and I'll say that, you know, I've really enjoyed being a part of the petroleum industry. I started from very humble beginnings. I was fortunate to have a seed that led to some technological innovations, and I've really been fortunate to have been able to serve. I'll stop there. So,
well, thank you so much.
All right.